Once safely ensconced in South America, most of the wanted Nazi war criminals sought to keep as low a profile as possible. Although they were relatively secure among the dictatorships, most continued to use false names and papers, and sometimes to change addresses or even nations every few years in an attempt to throw off any would-be pursuers. But for many of them, getting to South America involved a rather circuitous journey, usually via the Middle East, a journey that often lasted many years. Franz Stangl had arrived in Damascus, capital of the French protectorate of Syria, in September 1948. Bishop Alois Hudal had already lined up a job for Stangl, working in a textile mill. Former Sobibor deputy commandant Gustav Wagner also arrived in Damascus at the same time as Stangl, and quickly settled into a quiet life. Stangl was determined that his wife Theresa and their three daughters would be reunited with him as soon as possible, and he worked hard and carefully saved money for their passage out of Austria via Italy. In May 1949, the Stangl family was reunited in Damascus. Theresa's exit from Italy had been problem-free and very easy, even though it was known that she was the wife of a major war crime suspect. The Stangl family settled down to a period of great happiness and well-being. Franz was free from the fear of capture and punishment for the time being. The family lived relatively well for a short period, and the Stangl's marriage improved markedly. But then, quite suddenly, Stangl lost his job when the owner of the textile mill he was working for died. For some time, Stangl found it very difficult to find suitable work, and instead, Theresa took up the financial burden of the family and worked as a masseuse. The family lived in a boarding house that was full of Germans who were living in Syria under assumed names, indicating that they were, in all probability, also Nazi fugitives. Stangl was never sure, as everyone was careful not to speak to each other very often and to always use assumed names when they did. In December 1949, things changed for the better when Stangl found a job as an engineer with the Imperial Knitting Company. The family was able to move into a large and comfortable flat in the old part of Damascus. But the unwanted attentions of a neighbour towards Stangl's 14-year-old daughter convinced him that it was time to move on from Syria. He decided to go to South America, and Theresa was dispatched to visit the various South American consulates to discover which nation would accept Stangl and his family. Brazil was the most welcoming, and Stangl, identifying himself as an engineer, applied to emigrate. His application was accepted, and the Stangls sailed for Santos in Brazil via Genoa in Italy under their real names. Stangl had to pay for the relocation out of his personal savings, and it meant that when the Stangls arrived in Brazil, they were once again almost broke. Swallowing his pride, the man who had once been an SS officer and camp commandant, with the power of life and death over hundreds of thousands of people, instead went to work in another textile mill for the next 2 years, in the meantime also building a house in the Sao Paulo suburb of São Bernardo do Campo. In the meantime, many other Nazi war criminals were already living in South America. Argentina in particular was rapidly filling up with wanted fugitives, as was President Juan Perón's desire, many of them assisted by Bishop Hudal and his Vatican ratline. One of the most notorious fugitives, who was definitely aided by Hudal to escape, was a Prussian aristocrat and the son of a general, Ludolf von Alvensleben. He had commanded the West Prussian Selbstschutz, or self-defense paramilitary forces, during the German invasion of Poland in 1939. The Selbstschutz operated in cooperation with Einsatzgruppen shooting units, and they were tasked with exterminating a large number of Poles who were considered to be a threat to Nazi overlordship, including Jews, the nobility, teachers and professors, communists, military officers, and so on. Von Alvensleben's units killed at least 4,247 people before the Polish campaign was over, and the methods used were deliberately cruel and sadistic. A former adjutant to Heinrich Himmler, von Alvensleben went on to command SS security police, the Sicherheitsdienst or SD units, in the Crimea after the German invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941, where he ordered many more crimes against humanity to be committed by his men. In April 1945, von Alvensleben had been captured by the British and sent to the Neuengamme internment camp, from whence he had escaped. He fled with his family to Argentina in early 1946, assisted by Vatican papers provided by Hudal and others on the rat lines. Nothing more was heard about von Alvensleben until the 27th of November 1952, when President Perón granted him Argentine citizenship under the appropriate name Carlos Luca. Perón appointed von Alvensleben an inspector of fish farming in Hererose. Von Alvensleben lived in Buenos Aires until July 1956, when he moved to the town of Santa Rosa de Calamuchita, where he was fondly remembered by many of the older locals even today. In January 1964, a court in Munich issued an arrest warrant for von Alvensleben for the murders of the people I already spoke about while in command of the Selbstschützen in Poland. The Argentinians, having no extradition treaty in place with West Germany and having no wish to turn von Alvensleben over to face trial, simply ignored all representations that were made to them from West German diplomats. Von Alvensleben died on his birthday in 1970, a free man in Argentina. In February or October 1948, Eduard Rochmann, former commandant of the Riga ghetto in Latvia, emerged at the other end of a rat line in the Argentine capital, Buenos Aires. There he found work in an import-export company and kept a low profile. He bigamously married again in 1955, though the marriage was annulled less than 3 years later. Then, in 1968, Rochmann achieved what should have been security for life, Argentinian citizenship, under the false name of Federico Wagner. Already efforts were underway to identify and capture Rochmann. In 1959, a warrant had been issued in West Germany for his arrest for the crime of bigamy. A year later, the Austrians finally got their act together and issued an arrest warrant for Rochmann, citing him for the murders of at least 3,000 Jews between 1938 and 1945, for having been an overseer of forced labourers at Auschwitz concentration camp after his flight from Latvia, and for the murder of at least 800 children below the age of 10. Unfortunately, Austria was notorious for its inability to actually take such a prosecution anywhere, and that was left to the West Germans. In 1963, the Hamburg District Court issued an arrest warrant for Rochmann for a variety of war crimes. The problem was that Rochmann was safely ensconced in Argentina, a country which, at the time, was not disposed to cooperating with hunts for Nazi war criminals. It took until October 1976 before the West German Embassy in Buenos Aires made a formal extradition request to the Argentine Foreign Ministry. Thinking that it was a rather futile gesture considering that Argentina did not have in place an extradition treaty with West Germany, the Germans nonetheless repeated the request in May 1977. To the great surprise of not only the West Germans, but also the Argentine Foreign Ministry, the Office of the President announced that Argentina would consider the Rochmann extradition request. It has been suggested that, at the time, Argentina was facing a fair amount of criticism concerning its internal human rights record, and many elements of the government were perceived as anti-Semitic. Handing over the butcher of Riga would have gone some way to restoring the Argentine government's reputation. But they made the mistake of not placing Rochmann under arrest and duly tipped off about his likely fate should he have chosen to remain in Argentina. Rochmann fled across the border into Paraguay. In the capital, Asunción, on the 8th of August 1977, Eduard Rochmann apparently died. The body remained unclaimed for some time, and there was great speculation, including from the famed Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal, over whether Roschmann was in fact really deceased. Nothing further has been heard of Roschmann since, so it is fairly safe to assume that the man who died in Asuncion, carrying identity documents in the name Federico Wagner, was Roschmann. Suggestions that Roschmann had murdered someone who fitted his age and appearance, or that this was done by some shadowy Nazi organization like the Odessa, stretches the limits of credibility and is probably best relegated to fiction. Roschmann was not a senior Nazi, nor was he particularly well off. What he had become was a man who had been on the run for 3 decades, and that killed him. Justice finally caught up with Adolf Eichmann on the evening of the 11th of May 1960, outside the entrance to his modest house on Garibaldi Street, Buenos Aires. Amid dramatic scenes, Eichmann was kidnapped by a crack squad of Israeli secret agents. Eichmann had been actively hunted by the Jewish people throughout the 1950s, and in particular by Wiesenthal. In 1954, Wiesenthal had received reliable information that Eichmann was living and working in Buenos Aires. Information had also been received by the Mossad, Israel's intelligence organization, and on this basis they launched a long drawn-out operation to identify and then kidnap Eichmann, so that the administrative brain of the Holocaust could be placed on trial in Jerusalem. Eichmann, travelling on documents that had been issued to him by Bishop Hudal, found employment almost as soon as he arrived in Argentina. Posing as Ricardo Clement, Eichmann was assisted by former SS officer Carlos Fuldner and began work at an Argentinian-German hydroelectric firm called Capri that was located 500 miles northeast of Buenos Aires, close to the small town of Tucumán. Eichmann was junior management and diligent and efficient enough at his job to be quickly promoted. He lived in a simple rented house, rode horses around the alpine countryside, and learned to speak Spanish. In 1951, Eichmann felt so secure in Argentina that he contacted his wife through the Nazi Old Boy Network, and in June she journeyed to the Italian port of Genoa with their 3 sons. The boys all travelled using their father's real surname, while Eichmann's wife used her maiden name for the voyage. If intelligence agents had been watching the family, they could have followed them direct to Eichmann's hideaway in Argentina. Living in Buenos Aires in July 1952, the Eichmann family was reunited. It had been 5 years since Eichmann's wife had seen him. However, in early 1953, Capri went bust, and in April, Eichmann moved his family back to Buenos Aires, where he rented a bungalow in the rather shabby Olivos district of the city. Times were tough for the Eichmanns, and each business that Adolf tried failed, including a laundry, a fabric shop, and a rabbit farm. Eichmann's despair was only lifted by the birth of his 4th son, Ricardo, in 1953. After struggling for many years, in March 1959, Eichmann gained a job as a mechanic at the Mercedes-Benz plants that was located in the north of Buenos Aires. In 1960, the family moved into a small, one-story house that Adolf and his sons had built themselves on Garibaldi Street after Eichmann had purchased a plot of land. It was extremely basic accommodation, lacking running water and electricity. A man of routine, each evening Eichmann would alight at a bus stop 100 metres from his house and walk home. Before going into the house for his supper, Eichmann would inspect his vegetable garden and walk once around the outside of his house. It was this precise routine that enabled the Mossad agents who had been sent from Israel to kidnap him ample opportunity to plan their operation. On the evening of the 11th of May 1960, Eichmann alighted from a bus slightly later than normal. As he walked towards his front gate, he noticed an American car was parked about 20 metres from his house. The bonnet was up and several men were tinkering with the engine. As he drew level with the car, one of the men turned and asked him something in Spanish. As Eichmann paused to reply, the man grabbed his arms and the 2 men fell writhing into a nearby ditch. The other Mossad agents quickly hauled the terrified Eichmann into the back of the car and sped away. Within seconds, Eichmann realized that his kidnappers were Jews. Smuggled out of Argentina aboard a specially chartered El Al flight, Eichmann stood trial in Jerusalem for his crimes. On the 1st of June 1962, the 56-year-old Eichmann was hanged, his body cremated and his ashes scattered over the sea to make sure that there would never be any memorial to the man who had killed millions of Jews with a signature. The former Treblinka commandant Franz Stangl was an Austrian, so it was the responsibility of the Austrian authorities to have hunted him down and brought him to justice. But Vienna did absolutely nothing until 1961, when an arrest warrant was finally issued. By this time, the crimes that Stangl had committed at the Sobibor and Treblinka camps were very well known, so it is difficult to understand why the Austrians had not issued a warrant many years earlier. Unlike most of the other Nazi fugitives, Stangl had made absolutely no attempt to hide his real identity since he had arrived in Brazil from Syria. In August 1954, Stangl had even registered his details with the local Austrian consulate. The reason why the Austrians failed to spot Stangl was probably because his surname was quite common, and although the crimes that had been committed in the camps that had been under his command were well known, the name of the commandant was not. Guy Walters, in his book Hunting Evil, even suggests that Austrian diplomats may have been involved in concealing Stangl's location, protecting him, in effect, from efforts to apprehend him. However, there is no proof that the Austrians were colluding with Nazis. Rather, the evidence seems to indicate that they were simply disinterested in hunting down their fellow countrymen for crimes that were committed in a period the Austrian people were very keen to put behind them. So, the Austrian authorities sat on their hands and did nothing to further the apprehension of Franz Stangl. Instead, it was the Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal who provided the authorities with proof that Stangl was living and working in Brazil. And this information may have come from Stangl's embittered former son-in-law, Herbert Havel. Until the issue of an arrest warrant in 1961, Stangl had remained well below the radar as far as most Nazi hunters were concerned. At the end of 1955, Stangl had fallen ill with a mystery disorder. His wife, Theresa, had once again stepped into the breach and took a clerical job at the Mercedes-Benz plant in Sao Paulo. As part of his recuperation, Stangl had built a small workshop at his home and started a company that manufactured bandages for Brazilian hospitals. In October 1959, Stangl's wife got him a job with Volkswagen through her contacts in the local German motor trade. Stangl began as an engineer, but he was soon promoted to head of preventative maintenance and earned a commensurate high salary. Both salaries enabled the Stangls to move into the better Brooklyn district of Sao Paulo, where Stangl built another house. His attitude to being captured was fatalistic. "If it comes to it, I want to give myself up. I don't want to run away," said Stangl to his wife. Registering with the Austrian consulate under his real name proved that Stangl had no intention, unlike Eichmann and Dr. Mengele, of becoming a true fugitive. He almost seemed to want to be caught. Between October 1964 and August 1965, the Treblinka trial was held in Dusseldorf, West Germany. The event was widely reported in the world's media, and at the conclusion of the trial, 8 former SS men were sentenced to prison terms, ranging from 4 years to life. Stangl's name was obviously at the forefront of the trial, as he had commanded the camp. But even though he was living under his own name in Brazil, and he had registered his name and personal details with the Austrian consulate in Sao Paulo, and kept a regular correspondence with friends and family back in Austria, no one reported the location of the man who was being held responsible for murdering 900,000 people. When Adolf Eichmann was kidnapped and put on trial in Jerusalem, Stangl followed the case with great interest. He avidly read the Viennese newspapers and even bought books about Eichmann, though the subject was taboo between members of his family. Fellow murderer Dr. Josef Mengele, when he read about the Eichmann trial, immediately feared for his safety and began plans to flee to another non-extradition country. Franz Stangl did not flee. Instead, he just continued going to work at Volkswagen like the good and efficient worker that he had always been. One man who was on Stangl's trail was Wiesenthal. He claimed later that his first tip-off about Stangl's location had come from a cousin of Stangl's wife, Theresa, who, Wiesenthal claimed, visited him at his office in Vienna. Some historians doubt the story and believe that it was fabricated by Wiesenthal in order to cover up the more mundane reality of where the tip-off had actually come from. The story goes that this relative of Stangl had accidentally said too much and told Wiesenthal that Stangl was alive and well and working as a mechanic in the Volkswagen factory in Sao Paulo. Wiesenthal also claimed that another former Nazi came to see him seeking money in exchange for information. After negotiations, the seedy former Gestapo man told Wiesenthal that Stangl was living in Sao Paulo. In all probability, the person who really tipped Wiesenthal off about Stangl's location was Stangl's former son-in-law, Herbert Havel, who had already threatened Stangl with exposure in the early 1960s after an unhappy breakup with one of Stangl's daughters. With Wiesenthal popularizing the case against Stangl, the West German government asked the Brazilians to extradite Stangl to stand trial, and the Brazilians fully cooperated. Stangl was arrested by federal police on the 28th of February 1967, ignominiously dragged from his car outside his house after returning from a bar with one of his daughters. On the 22nd of June, he was extradited to West Germany to stand trial for the murders of 900,000 men, women and children. During the course of the trial, Stangl admitted his role in the killings, but he mounted what has come to be known as the Nuremberg Defense, after so many Nazis had claimed that they had simply been following orders during their trial before the International Military Tribunal. "My conscience is clear," stated Stangl from the dock in 1970. "I was simply doing my duty." Unfortunately for Stangl, at Nuremberg, this form of defence had been ruled inadmissible because all soldiers have the right, under international law and the accepted rules of war, to refuse any order that they have deemed to be immoral. There can be no more immoral order than that issued by Himmler for the killing of a million civilians, orders that Stangl had enthusiastically followed without question. Unsurprisingly, Stangl was found guilty on the 22nd of October 1970, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment. If he had been tried just after the war, he would have been hanged at the time. On the 28th of June 1971, Stangl died of heart failure at the age of 63, whilst he was serving his sentence inside Dusseldorf prison. Just a few hours before he suddenly died, Stangl had granted the author Gita Sereny one final interview. Sereny felt it was the closest Stangl ever came to taking responsibility for the terrible crimes that he had perpetrated. "In reality, I share the guilt," said Stangl, "because my guilt only now in these talks, now that I've talked about it all for the first time." Dr. Mengele had continued to lead a charmed life in South America, socializing on the edge of cafe society, while Adolf Eichmann had led a life marked by much more straitened financial circumstances, loneliness and isolation. He showed no remorse for his terrible crimes. Mengele's letters and notes confirmed that his cultural and political consciousness remained stuck in 1945 and that he was never able to recognize anything reprehensible about the atrocities he committed in his human laboratories at Auschwitz. He believed that he was simply killing people who were already sentenced to death. In Buenos Aires, Mengele had initially worked in construction soon after his arrival from Italy. Then he had used family money and bought into a pharmaceutical company, taking a 50% share in Fadro Farm. He had divorced his first wife and married again to Marta Mengele, the widow of his younger brother. The wedding had taken place in Uruguay, and then Marta and her 14-year-old son Dieter had moved in with Josef. Whilst in Argentina, he maintained contact with other high-profile Nazis, including Hans-Ulrich Rudel, one of the Luftwaffe's highest-scoring aces, who had been awarded the Knight's Cross with oak leaves, swords and diamonds, Germany's very highest gallantry decoration. Mengele set up a clinic where he had practiced, among other things, illegal abortions, and he was even briefly arrested by the police after one of his patients had died. When Adolf Eichmann was kidnapped from outside of his house in Buenos Aires by Israeli agents in 1960, Mengele feared that he would also be targeted. He was right to be afraid, for the Mossad had actually identified him, and they had decided not to snatch him then and there, as they still had Eichmann in a safe house in the city, and they could not safely smuggle two well-known Nazi war criminals out of the country at the same time without being discovered by the authorities. A Mossad agent had even physically seen Mengele on the street, which was how close the Israelis came to apprehending him. Mengele responded to the very real threat by immediately leaving the country and moving to Brazil, and then on to Paraguay, where he obtained a Paraguayan passport in the name of José Mengele. He lived in the German colony of Hohenau. The Paraguayan dictator, General Alfredo Stroessner, was of German descent, and he actively recruited Nazis to assist his government. After a while, Mengele moved back to Brazil and became a farm manager outside Sao Paulo in the small town of Nova Europa. He lived on a farm owned by the Stammers, Hungarian immigrants who did not know Mengele's true identity, but of course guessed that he was probably a Nazi fugitive. In 1974, Mengele's relationship with the Stammers came to an end. His increasing paranoia about being kidnapped by the Israelis made him a difficult and argumentative employee. Hans-Ulrich Rudel, who was an integral part of the Nazi Old Boy Network in South America, suggested to Mengele that he might like to move to Bolivia and live near Klaus Barbie, the wartime SD leader in France and butcher of Lyon, who was also a former American Counterintelligence Corps intelligence asset. Mengele declined, and instead he moved into a modest bungalow in a Sao Paulo suburb. In 1977, his son Rolf, from his first marriage, secretly visited him in Brazil, but he was stunned to discover that his father was very much an unreconstructed Nazi, who was keen to justify his experiments on children at Auschwitz. Mengele died aged 67 while swimming in the sea off Bertioga, Brazil on the 7th of February 1979, either from drowning or after suffering a stroke. He was buried under the name Wolfgang Gerhard, an alias that Mengele had been using since 1976. In 1985, West German police, who had issued an arrest warrant for Mengele decades before, raided the house of a Mengele family friend in the doctor's hometown of Gunzburg. There they discovered large amounts of documentation pertaining to the 3+ decades that Mengele had spent on the run, including details of his burial in Brazil. On the 6th of June 1985, the Brazilian authorities permitted Mengele's supposed grave to be opened and the human remains inside to be exhumed and sent for tests. Forensic examinations concluded that the remains were most probably those of Josef Mengele. In 1992, a DNA test on the remains confirmed that they were indeed Mengele's, and the question of his survival was settled once and for all. Mengele had managed to remain on the run for 34 years. In a gruesome twist to the story, Mengele's skeleton remains in storage today at the Sao Paulo Institute for Forensic Medicine, because the Mengele family have refused to take the bones from the Brazilian authorities. In a way, Mengele's skeleton is representative of the history of Nazi fugitives. For like the doctor's bones, the story has yet to be fully laid to rest, as many Nazis remain on the loose, even 7 decades after the end of the war.